30 than we really need, so we should be able to wrap up no later than 4:30, no matter what. The next speaker is Bill Kalick. Bill is a senior consultant at Summit Blue Consulting, and he's going to talk about the evaluation of DSR programs and technologies, and he's particularly familiar with implementation that has occurred in New York and New Jersey. All right, Bill.
There it is. Now everybody can hear me. Great. Somebody turned off the microphone on me. How's everybody doing after the break? Is everybody hanging in there? I've been in the industry now for about 15 years, and I don't think I've ever been in a room where so many topics were covered. You guys are doing a good job trying to keep up with all the information you're getting today. The topic I'm going to talk to you about today is, well, actually, let me say a little bit about myself and Summit Blue Consulting. Summit Blue is a utility consulting firm. We do program design, program evaluation, and a little bit of program implementation. Our real core is actually program evaluation. We've worked on the NYSERDA program evaluations for the last 4 years. We recently completed a market assessment for the New Jersey energy efficiency programs, and we're currently working on a market assessment for the renewable energy programs in New Jersey as well. Today I'm going to try and take you through an evaluation 101. What is evaluation? What's it mean to programs? Why you should do it? And I'm going to try and keep my discussion at about the 30,000 foot level. We could do a whole day on evaluation and the nuances of evaluation, and I don't want to go into all the details because I know you've had a lot of information already, so I hope I can keep it at the upper level. So go ahead. So why do evaluation? Why would you want to spend some of your program money doing evaluations? Well, all programs pose challenges. Evaluations help to ensure that high expectations are actually being met. There's been a lot of great program designs that you've heard about today, programs in California, New Jersey, NYSERDA's programs. They're all excellent programs, but they're all based upon a set of assumptions to the markets that they're actually being conducted in. And to take those programs and put them into the Pennsylvania market, you need to verify that those assumptions still apply in your market. So you need to do an evaluation. And we'll talk about different types of evaluation and when to do evaluations. As I mentioned, the evaluation transforms guesses and initial estimates and tracking data into actual program performance. It lets you verify your assumptions. Evaluation provides for accountability. It makes sure that you're getting the savings that you're paying for. There's been some recent articles in the press about evaluation programs that have experienced some difficulties in terms of the savings being actually achieved. Taken together, the process and impact evaluations are tools for improving the program. One of the things that you want to do once you develop a great program is to improve that program over time, to evolve the program as the market changes. And evaluations let you do that. Next. A good ongoing evaluation effort can help focus the efforts on obtaining achievable impacts with cost-effective designs. I think Chris Niemi laid out several good criteria for programs. Evaluation can help you maintain and help you verify that you're achieving those criteria. Evaluation helps to improve programs. Where are the energy savings being achieved? What are the costs and the impacts being achieved? Which consumers participate in the programs, and why do they participate? Which consumers, more importantly in my view, is which consumers are not participating in the program, and how do you reach those consumers? What are the barriers that those consumers have to participation? And you do have some programs where consumers drop out, some large CNI programs where they start into the programs, they find various reasons why they won't actually follow through with the program. And evaluation will help get at those and help you improve the program so that the next time those customers stay in the program. Again, as you can probably glean by what I'm saying, the overall objective of evaluation is to provide the information necessary to make good decisions about your program planning and your program design. Some of the specifics that evaluations can do are estimate the energy and capacity reductions, assess changes in the quality and reliability of service, as I mentioned, determine the cost of programs, determine customer satisfaction and acceptance of programs, translate program impacts into environmental changes, and to also assess other non-energy benefits. I apologize for reading these, but I've been sitting in the back of the room all day, and I've had a hard time actually seeing the screen, so hopefully this helps the folks back there. We'll talk about a few of these things, including the assessing of the non-energy benefits as I go through the slides. Slide. These are the types of impact or types of evaluations, that I'm going to be going through today. There's probably been some mention of these around the working group through the process. I know there's been some mentions of the NYSERDA work we've done on the impact evaluations. I think Mike gave out some of the numbers that we've put together for NYSERDA on doing an impact evaluation. There's also process evaluation, market assessment. Market assessments are what I mentioned that we're currently involved in the renewable energy market in New Jersey, and we just finished up a market assessment in the energy efficiency market in New Jersey. And lastly, I'll talk about the non-energy benefits type of evaluation. So an impact evaluation, pure definition here, is a study conducted to measure the change in energy usage, such as KWH, KW, therms, attributed to energy efficiency or demand response programs. How much savings are you getting? One of the key issues, though, in an impact evaluation is actually determining what would have been done without the program. I'm going to say that again because it's one of the base concepts of an impact evaluation. What would have been done? What would that customer have used if that in that program they did not they did not participate in that program? See, even I have trouble with it sometimes. Some of the data sources that you can use for an impact evaluation are the program tracking databases, participant applications, and participant surveys. One of the things I'm going to highlight here is that program tracking databases are essential for doing any kind of good evaluation. You need to know who participated in the program. You need to know what kind of projects they put in. You need to know what the estimated size of that project is. So any good program design should also include a good program tracking database. Participant applications and participant surveys can be used to get at that baseline question that I just raised. What would they have done without participating if they hadn't participated in the program? I'll get it right yet. Next slide. So the baseline, it's the change in overall energy use or demand that would have occurred in the absence of the program. Some of the common approaches for getting at the baseline are engineering estimates, modeling, building with or without the measures that they installed using either DOTO or EQUEST. These are just two examples of building simulations. You could do engineering calculations as well, doing the baseline equipment versus the high efficiency equipment. Those are ways to get at the impact. You could do a statistical comparison or control approaches. You can estimate the baseline energy use that are derived from a comparison group of consumers or other data that serves as a proxy. One thing that's done a lot in the industry, and I'm not going to get into lots of details, is doing a billing data analysis comparing a control group to a group that actually participated in the program and comparing their change in energy use. So if you know that the control group went down in energy consumption by 3% and the actual participants in the program, you see a 10%. You can probably assume that that 8% is achievable, is directly related to the actual program. Again, I can't say claim that it is related to the program. There may be other factors in there, but that may be one of the causes. Next slide, please. So here's an illustration of what I'm talking about by estimating the baseline and calculating the impacts. So I'm going to try and go up here and point to this and try and be heard. So yell if you can't hear me. So here's what the customer was using at time equals zero. Their energy trend was down. At time equals participation, they actually installed a measure. And that measure reduced their energy consumption down to here. So the change
between this level and this level is actually...
Oh, no, sorry, that's better.
So if they would have come down here without the program, so the change in the program, related to the program, is this change here. The natural change is from B to C.
All right, there we go. Should I go through that again? So the natural change is what they would have saved from B to C. This is the natural reduction. And this is the reduction associated with the program. So this is the gross overall savings that you would see on a customer's bill, but can't really claim all that because of the natural trend. That's why establishing the baseline is such an important issue to impact evaluation. Next slide. This gets at the same issue of, you know what the gross impacts are of the participant. They've, you know, let's take an easy example of lighting. They did a lighting retrofit, and they reduced their lighting by, say, 100 kWh. And that would be your gross impact, that 100 kWh. But in addition, there may have been other factors that came along as a result of the program. Those other factors are what we call adjustments. So there's a net to gross ratio, which is the adjust for the gross impacts for the impacts attributable to the program. Now I'll go into what those other impacts are. Free ridership. So that person who, that company that put a lighting retrofit in and saved 100 kWh, they actually may have been pretty likely to do that without the program. And that's what we call free ridership. Free ridership is the percent of savings that would have been done anyway. Another adjustment to the gross savings is spillover. Participants' spillover is the additional savings achieved by participants due to their participation in the program. The participant may have claimed a rebate for 100 kWh, but may have found out it was such a great idea that they went off and did 20 kWh more. That's participant spillover. They didn't get a rebate for it, but they were influenced by the program to do more above and beyond what they did. Another example of participant spillover is they were educated through the lighting project on savings and decided that they were going to look for other opportunities within their company to save energy, and actually went about and did motor retrofits. This had nothing to do with the lighting program or the lighting offer, but was a result of the education that they received. That would be considered participant spillover. Non-participant spillover, another adjustment to net savings results for a program, are non-participants that made efficiency improvements as a result of the program's outreach and marketing. So the non-participant heard about the program, said that, yeah, lighting is a really good thing to do. I'm using lighting here as an easy example. Lighting is a really good thing to do. We're going to go ahead and do it, not wanting to perhaps fill out the rebate forms. So that would be considered non-participant spillover. Next slide. So that was an impact evaluation in 10 minutes or whatever it was. It was impact evaluation, and there's a lot more to it, obviously. The modeling of the baseline where I just covered the engineering estimates and the statistical estimates, there's a whole science around that. And I'd love to come back and talk to you about that extensively some other time, but I don't have time for that. So we'll move on to process evaluation. It's an examination of how well a program has been or is being implemented, including the efficiency of service delivery, the effectiveness of the promotional materials, and the level of customer satisfaction. This is really where you get at how well the program is functioning on a daily basis. Are you reaching the people that you want to reach? Are they getting the message? Are you delivering the program in an effective and efficient manner? Are customers calling about the program and being delayed for 2 weeks before they get a response to their inquiry? Those are the type of issues that you'll get at through a process evaluation. They're really, really useful in refining a program delivery and finding out where the problems are and ironing them out as quickly as possible. Next slide. some of the tools that you can use for a process evaluation are participant satisfaction surveys, market actor interviews. We found that market actor interviews are great, actually getting those project developers on the phone where you can talk to them and you can hear feedback in their own words. You know, how is the program working? What isn't working? What is working? What are the barriers to participation? Those are all really good things that you can find out through direct interviews. Participant, non-participant surveys. This is where you can get at some of the reasons why people aren't participating. Talking to non-participants has been one of the keys in process evaluation that I don't think gets enough credit. Benchmarking studies, what other states are doing? What are they achieving in terms of their savings? Focus groups has been a good tool, and project documentation. Looking at the materials, the database, and the decision memos, all that helps inform how the program delivery process is going. The other type of evaluation that I wanted to hit on is this market assessment, which I mentioned we just finished up in New Jersey. It's an investigation into the structure, the barriers, the baselines associated with the market that the program is operating in and the effects of the market. So it was mentioned earlier today, the idea of a market transformation program. So a program that may not be achieving savings in the first or second year, but actually may be achieving savings over the longer term. So you're really looking at changing the way the market's operating, like stocking practices. You really want to work with the suppliers to improve their stocking of high-efficiency equipment. So a market assessment will actually take a look at where the market was in year one of the program and then where the market was in the year five of the program and see how the program's actually changed how the market operates. And that really is essential to, again, how well the program's functioning its goals. The other thing a market assessment that I wanted to cover, what market assessment is really good at doing, is identifying barriers to participation, barriers to the sale of energy efficient equipment, surveys. Actually, you can flip to the next slide. This is what I was getting at. It really gets at the market barriers. What's preventing a customer from participating in the program? Are there aspects of the market that are preventing equipment from getting there? Is there a supply issue? This is one of the things that we're looking at in New Jersey right now in the renewable energy program, is the PV panel supply issue. Resource acquisition programs, market assessments are really useful for understanding the impacts of the rebates, understanding free ridership, which I mentioned also under impact evaluation, and the change in the availability of projects, of product, again, the solar panel issue. Both in market transformation programs and resource acquisition programs, the market assessment is, again, used to refine the programs. Methods that I've mentioned are interviews with market actors, equipment vendors, sales representatives, equipment distributors. Sales data research study are used to understand sales patterns, trends. These are really useful tools for a market assessment where you can show how the distribution of energy efficient equipment in a certain sectors, like energy efficient clothes washers, how that's changed over time in a jurisdiction, say, for instance, New York and New Jersey. You can attribute some of those impacts to how well the program's doing. Using sales data is one of the ways to get at that. It's often very difficult, though, to get the sales data for energy efficient equipment down to the state level or the utility level. So there are a lot of things have to be done to get around that. One example is to go out and do stocking practice surveys, going out and looking at stores and seeing what they stock in terms of the equipment efficiencies. Non-energy benefits is another evaluation. This is a more recent type of evaluation that's occurred. We just finished up NEBS, or non-energy benefits evaluation, for NYSERDA. And it's an evaluation to identify and quantify the non-energy benefits associated with the program implementation or participation. Some examples of non-energy benefits include reduced emissions and environmental benefits, productivity improvements, reduced debt, lower levels of arrearage, reduced disconnects and reconnects, more on-time payments, higher comfort, convenience level of participant, and job creation. A lot of these things are very difficult to quantify, but we've done our best, and we've worked with statisticians and econometricians to develop models to really get at what are the economic impacts of the energy efficiency programs. Job creation-wise, we've heard mentioned today of home performance programs and the jobs that are created in the jurisdictions as a result of home performance programs. We've tried to quantify those impacts. Next slide. So the uses of non-energy benefit evaluation is to understand the full impact of the public benefits and energy efficiency programs. A lot of the benefit cost analysis work that's done looks at the avoided cost impacts of the energy efficiency measure. So how much energy it's, or I guess what's the benefit to the consumers for that measure. What non-energy benefits actually lays on top of that is not only the benefits to the utility and the consumers, and then there's the environmental benefits, but also the economic benefits, and that's where non-energy benefits come in. Help a program to become more effective by providing sales enhancement information, gain support of program from a wider range of stakeholders, and determine cost-benefit cost-effectiveness ratios for the program. That's what I was just referring to. Go ahead. How do you do a non-energy benefits evaluation? You conduct surveys with participants and subject matter experts. You can do the economic impact modeling and impact estimation that I've talked about. And, of course, use secondary research and information. For instance, the home performance program that I was mentioning, you can take a look at the number of HVAC contractors in the jurisdiction before or after the program, and see sort of the job impact from that. Typical evaluation budgets for demand-side resource portfolios run from about 4 to 8%. It may seem like a lot, but in many cases, conducting an evaluation can often save 8% in terms of improving the efficiency of the program and improving the efficiency of the savings that you're getting. Impact evaluation that actually finds an additional 8% savings pays for itself right there. Next slide. Evaluation frequency. How often should you conduct these different types of evaluation? Impact evaluations, we recommend that they should be conducted every 2 years or as required. Some jurisdictions, the utility commissions have laid out that the impact evaluations need to be done every year. Or at least a verification process needs to occur every year. The impact evaluation is one of the key ways to really keep track of what's going on with your program. Are you getting the savings that you expected? And where are those savings coming from? So they need to be done at least every 2 years. Process evaluations, we recommend that they be done within a year of launching a new program or after any major substantial change in the program. So if you've adopted a program, say, based upon another jurisdiction, perhaps like NYSERDA's Energy Star Homes program for Pennsylvania, you want to do a process evaluation right after, about a year after you implement the program, so you know whether the assumptions that were operating in the New York program are consistent with what's going on in Pennsylvania. And this gives you the ability to adopt and adapt the program and quickly before you get too far down the road. Market assessment, recommended to do every 2 to 5 years to support the potential analysis, program development, and baseline assessment. Again, you need to allow enough time on a market assessment to for the market to change. You need to allow enough time to see the impacts of a market transformation program. So that's why we recommend 2 to 5 years on that. Non-energy benefits, 2 to 5 years as well, or as needed. If programs are coming online or the program is, you believe, having significant economic impact, other than the program, whether it's creating jobs in the area, you'd want to do a non-energy benefit evaluation to quantify that. Evaluation funds should be allocated based upon a combination of program budgets and expected savings. In other words, if you're getting a bulk of your savings from CNI, you probably want to spend a bulk of your evaluation dollars on CNI. You would expect the breakdown to be relative to the impacts that you're getting in terms of savings. The types of evaluation that I've highlighted are sort of after the programs have been developed and they're in the field. You do the process evaluation, the impact evaluation, the market assessment. Some of the other things I wanted just to point out here at the end is there are other types of evaluations that should be occurring prior to the program being developed. And Chris mentioned a little bit about these, a potential study. A potential study is a study to find out what the potential is by market and by sector within a jurisdiction. And this can start at the high level of the technical potential, which, you know, given as much money as you have, what can you actually achieve in terms of savings? The next one, level down from that, would be economic. Okay, what passes the benefit cost test? What actually makes economic sense to do? And then the achievable level would be, of that, what percent do you think you can actually get? What percent penetration can you get? Baseline studies looking at what other jurisdictions have achieved in the past can help you get from the economic to the achievable potential. This will help you really define programs that should be put in place, whether you should be focusing on, as Mike was mentioning, if you've only got a 1% penetration in Energy Star homes, that obviously seems like a really good market to go after. There may be other markets where the potential just isn't as high as some of them. I'll throw out one that I'm not sure about, but, you know, high efficiency motors. For some reason, Pennsylvania may be further along than other parts of the country. It would be good to know that before you actually roll out a program. Baseline studies. What are the current practices in the market, and what are the saturations of those? It goes hand in hand with a potential study. Again, useful information to have during program design. I just threw those in here at the end because I think that they're very valuable to think about as Pennsylvania is working towards developing a portfolio program. You need to kind of know those two things, where you're starting from and what's going on in the market today. Next slide. This is my contact information. Thank you very much for your time. You can reach me there with any questions you might have. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. Next, we will hear from Matthew Plant, who is Director of Business Development PJM for Enernoc. And he's going to talk about DSR programs for CNI customers. And then our last presenter of the day will be John Stremmel, who will be on telephonically, and he is on notice that we're a little bit behind. So if you can finish by 4, we'll be good for him.
No problem. Thanks,
Karen. All right. Thank you.
We in the demand response industry often talk about the link between wholesale energy prices and retail prices. And at 3:30 on a Friday, I realize that I'm just about the link between this conference and your weekend. So I will try to be brief. I manage Enernoc's business in PJM, so I spend a lot of my time here in Pennsylvania. And I thought it would be helpful, as we think about ways to encourage demand side in Pennsylvania, if we looked at other states and what they've been able to accomplish and how they've been able to accomplish what they've been able to accomplish. So I would like to talk about Connecticut first to see what Connecticut has done, what they've been able to accomplish. Before I do that, I promise not to make this a vendor showcase, But I did just want to take 2 or 3 minutes to let you know about Enernoc, my company. We are solely focused on demand response. It's our entire business. We've got about 110 employees, and we work in most of the deregulated markets. So we're very active in New England to New York, PJM, California. We perform demand response audits for utilities. We sign bilateral contracts with fully integrated utilities. And what we do is we provide them with peaking capacity. And we do that through working with C&I customers, helping C&I customers find ways to curtail load. So if we move to the next slide, I'll tell you a little bit about how we do that. We're pretty much technology agnostic. So we are not a wholly air conditioning company, or we don't just focus on lighting. We try to go get capacity from companies, and we'll do that however we see fit. So we come up with very tailored curtailment strategies. So we might go get some lighting, we might go get some air conditioning, but we get a lot of business process as well. And we find that that's the best way for us to get as many megawatts and not leave any megawatts on the table. About 60% of our load, about 60% of our 450 megawatts is directly load control. So we essentially push a button and load drops at customer sites. And about 60% of our load is load curtailment and not distributed generation. We do have distributed generation assets that we use in certain programs. The NOC in Enernoc stands for Network Operations Center. And this is the back part of Enernoc. Up in Boston, where we're headquartered, we have a fully staffed NOC. And what we do is we take data from customer facilities every 5 minutes or every 1 minute, and we feed it into our NOC. And we're continually looking at what customers' consumption patterns are. And so I would say that the distinguishing part about my company is that we think it's the marriage of energy efficiency and demand response. So we help, there's really two ways in which that happens. The first way is that the customer first starts to participate in demand response programs. They then come to us and say, this has been great, Matt. What else can we do from an energy efficiency standpoint? How else can you help me? So we help them think about retrofits, and we help them think about commissioning and all these types of things. The second way that energy efficiency happens is that we are continually looking at their consumption patterns. And so we work with hundreds of supermarkets. And so a supermarket chain might have 60 stores in our portfolio. And what we'll do is we'll keep an eye on the supermarket's consumption. And so we'll notice that about 55 out of the 60 supermarket stores at 11 o'clock at night, their load drops off. But five stores don't. Five stores' load stays a little bit high. And so we call the supermarket and we say, we've noticed this pattern. What's going on here? Here are the five stores. And they say, aha. And those five stores, it turns out that those are the five stores that haven't dropped the lighting to night setback mode. And so they then make those changes, and it saves them a whole bunch of kWhs. So that's how we go about doing our business. And then my final vendor showcase slide is next. And it's just a little bit about us. But I think it's that combination of energy efficiency and demand response that has led to a little bit of the recognition we've got. Two of the more notable things is that Platts named us in 2006 an energy pioneer, or technology pioneer, I think they called it. And the World Economic Forum named us a technology pioneer, and we're going to participate in the World Economic Forum meetings in 2007 and 2008, so that's pretty exciting. But thanks for the opportunity to speak here today. We've been pretty active in working with PUCs to help them think about demand response. And so we have been extremely active, particularly with PUCs in California and in Connecticut, to help them implement some pretty effective demand response programs. Thanks. Next slide, please. So here are some good conditions and good characteristics of demand response programs that we like to think about. And coincidentally, a lot of these principles have been applied in Connecticut and in California, and that's why they've had some successful programs. But one of the things we'd like to think about is parity. So let's pay demand response capacity as if it were a peaking plant, because that's essentially what it is. So we're online and we're able to come offline 100 hours a year, just like a peaking plant is. And so in order for us to do that reliably and to guarantee that, we've got to be paid like a power plant gets paid. A couple of good things about demand response as opposed to generation is that demand response has no transmission line loss. So a megawatt of demand response is really a megawatt. When you also have a megawatt of demand response, you take away the necessary reserve margin. So if you build a 100 megawatt power plant and you've got 100 megawatts of demand, well, you need to build a 15% demand margin, a reserve margin. But when you essentially take away a peak of demand response, you're taking away need to build that, that reserve margin as well. We'd like to think about the other important parts on this slide. We like to think about transparency, and that is giving utilities and giving system operators real-time information about what we're doing. So our customers can see in real time when an event is called and when we're dropping their load. Our customers can log onto our portal and they can see in real time exactly what their load has done. So at 3:45 they were at 1.2 megawatts, an event was called, and 10 minutes later at 3:55 they're at 600 kilowatts. So they can see what happened, and that helps them a lot, and it encourages them actually to give more demand response. The other half of that is that not only does the customer see it, but the utility sees it and the system operator sees it. And that, we think, system operators like that a lot, to essentially be able to say, I've got a power plant that I can count on here. When I call Enernox to give us, you know, 100 megawatts of demand response capacity, I see it in real time. So it feels to them like they're pushing a generator button. And then the final point is we encourage penalties. We love penalties for performance. If you're going to pay us, penalize us. And so we know that we'll be there for you, and so we encourage to be, you know, to be penalized like a generator's penalized when they don't show up. So having said all that, it's now I can turn to Connecticut and let you know what they've been able to accomplish. Connecticut, I think, is a recognized leader in demand response. They had a real issue back in 2002 with transmission constraints and capacity constraints, and so they issued an all-source RFP. It was open to generation, it was open to transmission, it was open to demand response. And at that time when they issued that, demand response made up about 1.5% of Connecticut's peak. There were 26 bids, you know, there were 26 proposals submitted to that RFP process. And demand response was by far and away the winner of that RFP process. I think I saw some friends from Converge in the room a little bit earlier, and they were one of the winners of this process as well. But that was the first step that they took towards really encouraging demand response to come online in Connecticut. And all they did to encourage it was say, hey, we'll allow it, but we'll also allow generation. It turns out that we were cheaper and we were quicker online, so that's why we won. So since 2002, 2003 actually is when we signed the contract with ISO New England, we've been building up demand response capacity in Connecticut. In 2005, Connecticut passed what was called 0501, but it was an act concerning energy independence. And the goal of that act was to reduce Connecticut's peak by 10% by 2010, which was kind of lofty given, you know, population growth and just general load growths in the area. That was in July of 2005. In December of 2005, Connecticut's the DPUC in Connecticut approved a plan to help mitigate federally mandated congestion charges, FMCCs. And as a result of that, they approved a contract between between my company and CLNP. And I'll talk a little bit more, but that contract essentially is a contract between us and the utility, but it's we adhere to the rules of ISO New England's demand response programs. So I think in Pennsylvania, it's helpful to think about PJM's existing demand response programs, which are in many ways very good. And so I think it's helpful to think in that context, to think in terms of it's not just the system operator that was doing this, but it's the utility that gets involved also, but it's governed by the rules of the ISO. Next slide, please. Thanks. So how much demand response is attainable? We have always said that, you know, 5 and 10% of a system's peak is demand response attainable. And we've now reached that level in Connecticut. So it's pretty exciting. It's been a great case study, and it's gotten a lot of attention. The state of Connecticut's peak demand is about 7,000 megawatts. There's right now about 435 megawatts of demand response capacity in Connecticut. That's about 6%. We think it's headed towards 10% in the entire state, which would be 700 megawatts of demand response capacity. Why do we think that? Because in southwest Connecticut, where the programs first started, where that first RFP back in 2002 was just for the southwest portion of it, whereas the 2005 contract is for the entire state, southwest Connecticut has already hit 10%. So that's a pretty great milestone for it. And I think it's important to look at what percent of New England's peak, or what percent of New England's demand response comes from Connecticut, because these ISO programs apply to the entire state, all six New England states. But Connecticut, which only makes up 27% of New England's peak, has 71% of New England's demand response. And I think that the reason for that is because ISO New England has encouraged demand response, and the DPUC has really encouraged demand response in Connecticut, and they've put in place some programs which encourage it, some funding which encourages it, and that's why they've got 435 megawatts and are moving towards probably about 700 megawatts of demand response capacity in Connecticut. Thanks. This is just another slide which shows the growth. So in January of 2004, there were about 60 megawatts of demand response capacity in the state of Connecticut. And since then, from 2004 to 2005, from 2005 to 2006, and from 2006 to January 2007, it's doubled. It's doubled every year. It's gone from 60 to 120. It's gone from 120 to about 250. And it's gone from 250 to 435. So it's had a pretty good trajectory over that time. Thank you. This slide, my generator friends absolutely love this slide. And this slide shows the effect of demand response on wholesale prices. So this is actually just one graph from a single day back, and it's back in 2004 when there was a real demand response event. But I haven't had to update the slide because it's held true for every event we've done since then. When you use demand response to hit system peaks, wholesale prices come down. This shows at 11 o'clock where you see that box start. That was when the event started, and the event lasted for the next 2 hours. And you can see prices were, you know, tailing upwards as they always do from 9 o'clock until, you know, noontime. The event hit, prices went down, the event ended at 1 o'clock, and boom, prices went right back up. So generators don't love this slide, but it's true. PJM, if you go to www.pjm.com, I think they have three or four news items on the right-hand side of their website, and one of those news items is a clip that says that demand response saved the system $650 million. That is from a single week in August of 2006. And they can give more color on that than I can. But what they did essentially was go back and they modeled what would have happened, what would prices have been on their 144,000 megawatt system had we not used about 1,000 megawatts of demand response to take down the peaks on basically five hot days in August of last year. And the net savings on that model was $650 million. So that's a reasonable amount of money. Don't quote me on this, and Susan Covino's here. The amount of money spent to get that $650 million of savings was something in the range of $5 million. $5 million to get to $650 million in savings. So that's not bad. I think ratepayers will like that statistic a whole lot. Thanks. So I've just said a whole bunch of good stuff about PJM. I think there's a lot of work to be done, and there's a lot of growth to come. So in my mind, PJM programs are improving, and PJM has done a lot to make some pretty significant changes to its demand response programs in the last couple of years. I think there's been about 500% growth increase in the use of the economic demand response program from 2004 to 2005. That's obviously significant, and it's increasing since then. So we're definitely on the right path. I think that we're not even close to where we'll ultimately get. Two of the big changes that I mentioned, the first one is that demand response, the economic load response program of PJM is now a permanent part of its market. So when we go to end users to say, we've got this program, we think you should get involved, they say, how long is it? And we say, it's a pilot project for a year. 9 times out of 10, they say, we're really not interested. It's kind of not worth my time if it's only a year-long program. Well, PJM said, guess what? Demand response is important. It's now the economic load program is a permanent part of their market. So we're allowed to go sign up end users for 3 to 5 years, which gives them a little bit more knowledge that they'll make, that'll be worth their time, that the investment will be worth their time, any metering that they'll have to do will be worth their time, et cetera, et cetera. And the second part, which is an extremely progressive step that PJM took, was that they were the first RTO or the first ISO to allow demand response to participate in its ancillary services market. So this is a big step, and it's been encouraging for me to see not only the growth of demand response as a product, but the use of it into the ancillary services market. So it can now participate as a synchronized reserve. They've shown that it's just as reliable to do this as generation. This is definitely going to have it's going to decrease the price that utilities and that ratepayers end up paying for the service of synchronized reserves. So this is a good thing. It's also cleaner. So this is another good thing. Where are we now? Well, in PJM, which is my proxy for Pennsylvania, we had in 2006 about 300 sites and about 1,400 megawatts worth of demand response capacity in the economic load response program. And this represents about 1% of PJM system peak. The average size of the customers is still large. It's, if you divide 294 into 482, you get about 5 megawatts. So for the most part, the customers in these programs have been industrials. And so we're kind of ferreting out to, you know, include commercials and include institutionals. So we hope that number drops. We hope the number of sites really increases. And we'd be, you know, happy to talk about ways in which we think we can really encourage more demand response in the state of Pennsylvania. So that is all I have. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Matthew. John?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Hi, John. This is Karen. How are you doing?
Very good, Karen.
Good. All right. Are you ready for us?
I'm kind of, can you hear me?
Pardon me?
I took it off speaker because I figured you could probably hear me better just from my headset.
Yeah, it's we have a pretty clear, we can hear you pretty clearly. There is a little static, as I explained to you earlier on the phone, but I think we'll be all right. And we do have your PowerPoint up on the screen here. And let me just briefly introduce you. On the phone we have John Stremmel, who is Senior Vice President with Energy Connect, and he is going to give us a perspective of a curtailment service provider on removing artificial barriers for participation in PJM programs. So if you're ready to go, John, we're all ready to listen to your presentation.
Yes, thank you, Karen, for the introduction. The presentation that I'm making today, and my apologies, the travel gods just didn't allow me to be there this week. Liz Kimmel was also supposed to be there, and she came down with the flu this week, so all we can do is promise to participate personally in the future.
Right.
It just didn't work out this time. The presentation that I'm making today is really looking at the economic benefits of demand response. The social benefits are much larger, and they're quite often addressed specifically, but I'm looking at smaller customers in demand response programs, as you'll see from the presentation, and how their participation and benefits are justified from the economic benefits that are out there to the system, rather than looking at incentives or subsidies or what would be something that attacked directly the social benefits. So if you turn to page 2, what I'm going to talk about in this brief presentation is just the impact of large customers and small customers. Large customers can transform the system in a significant way. If we can pull in small customers, and you'll see that I define that as customers about in the 1 megawatt to 5 megawatt category, that if we pull them into demand response programs, we can really change the system in a fundamental way, how it operates day by day in a very substantial way. The rest of the presentation is going to look at it from a business perspective and look at the business case, what the payback is for small customers, what the economics would have to be for an aggregator or a utility to offer the service such that it was really a money-making proposition, and then how the PJM programs are ideally suited to support and augment the programs that are being considered in Pennsylvania. And so it makes sense to include the PJM programs as part of the entire package when you're looking at things for Pennsylvania. So if there are questions from the room, please interrupt me. I'll try to address those at the time, but I'll depend on Karen for interrupting me so that I can hear the question and respond to it. So if you turn to page 3.
Just let me tell you, John, that our room isn't real conducive to asking questions, so there hasn't been much of that today. What we're going to do instead is collect their questions by email, and then we'll group them, sort them, and send them out to the panelists and ask you to respond that way.
Oh, great.
Okay.
Yeah. So as we look at page 3, it's the title is A Few Assertions, and what my contention is that most programs focus on the large users that are 10 megawatts or more. There are fundamental changes that can happen in the grid and the grid organization of the grid when demand response systematically includes a large number of customers, particularly those that can reduce 1 megawatt or less. And we can address reliability issues really well with large customers. If we're going to fundamentally change grid organization, we need to include the smaller customers. And they have unique needs. And opportunities that can be resolved with contract flexibility and as a look across programs or alternatives. They're always shopping to make their business more efficient and more effective. And so one of the impacts is that successful new programs often cannibalize customers from old ones. So if we turn to page 5, and we look at a 1 or 2% load curtailment or load shift, it's a good start for large customers, and it'll have a real significant impact on reliability. But for most regions, if we extend this, our customer reach into the 0.5 to the 5 megawatt category, we're looking at load consumption that usually is 40 to 50% of the total load. And so we can dramatically extend DR impact by reaching out to these smaller customers and being able to incorporate them in the programs. And a 5% price responsive load impact would change not only the reliability of the grid from these customers, but for daily economics. And then if we turn to page 6. Now, given that those are basically assertions that I'm making that, that folks can check out and you look at the load data, I think that you'll find that that's the case. So let's look at the business case for this 1 megawatt customer. A 1 megawatt customer will have an electricity bill if he's paying about 10%, 10 cents a kilowatt hour. That'll be about $50,000 a month. So the bill associated with reducing or moving about 10% of his consumption is probably $5,000 a month. And you look at a ballpark value to the grid of shifting 10% of the customer's consumption, we're probably talking about something that's a few thousand dollars a month. So then if we turn to page 7. So now we have a customer that where the potential from the grid or payments from the grid or participating in the grid are a few thousand a month. What does that mean for how that customer can justify the time and effort? And our experience is that that probably means that the customer is willing to invest something on the order of about 15 minutes a week. Not really very much more than that. And if training's involved, maybe there are a couple of hours that they're willing to invest, but that really is something that they're not going to come back very regularly for. It needs to be easy to update, perhaps something that's internet-based. Now, when it comes to operation and responding to events, that, especially if they're happening often, a few times a week, for instance, really what the customer would like is for the aggregator to tell them what to do, when to do it, and preferably to do it for them. So this is one reason that in the vision that Energy Connect has of the market and reaching these customers, we're working with folks like Johnson's Control, Bowen Train, Siemens, so that these systems, their internal building automation systems can respond automatically to signals in such a way that it doesn't really change the comfort level of folks in the building. So if we turn to page 8, that's the business case for the size customer that's a 1 megawatt customer. He's got a little time to spend. There are a few thousand dollars a month in it for him, and he needs it to be pretty seamless and effortless in order to respond and to reap those benefits. Now, as you look at it from the aggregator's point of view, that a customer will really have revenue that's coming in a few thousand a month, meter cost could easily consume that benefit. So that's going to be one of the major hurdles of taking programs to customers at this level. If the aggregator specializes in meter equipment, one of the problems is that the equipment gets installed and the aggregator doesn't stay around for the business end of actually moving the energy. aggregator's point of view, there really needs to be thousands of customers to justify the systems development that has to go behind the implementation to make it easy for the customer to interface with the system. Then page 9, the last page of the presentation, really focuses now, if that's the aggregator's perspective and that's the customer's perspective, what does that mean for designing programs then in Pennsylvania? And if the program has a large footprint, aggregators have the ability to address this audience. I think what we're going to find is that most of the programs in Pennsylvania are going to be targeted for a larger customer. But these customers are important, and PJM has the ability to standardize a program over a much larger footprint. And therefore, the case I'm trying to make is that that really means that PJM programs should become a fundamental part of what's being offered in Pennsylvania. And looking at it from that perspective, they're not competing, but in fact, they're supporting what the efforts are as we go forward in Pennsylvania. And that's the crux of my presentation.
All right, thank you, John. Does anyone have any questions that you would like to have asked while John's still on the phone? Okay. All right, well, thanks very much for your perspectives. We appreciate that. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Okay. My pleasure.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Bye.
I'm just real quickly going to do the wrap-up and next steps, and then I'm going to turn it over to Dan Griffiths, who's going to lead a brief discussion on some FERC, PJM, forum, wholesale rules-related issues.